148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyim min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu ribbiyyuna kathir. Fama wahanu lima asabahum fi sabilillahi wa ma da'ufu wa mastakanu wallahu yuhibbu s-sabirin wa ma kana qawluhum illa an qalu رَبَّنَا اغْفِرْ لَنَا ذُنُوبَنَا وَإِسْرَافَنَا فِي أَمْرِنَا رَبَّنَا اغْفِرْ لَنَا ذُنُوبَنَا وَإِسْرَافَنَا فِي أَمْرِنَا وَثَبِّتْ أقدامنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord. So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, "Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair, and make firm our feet and help us against the unbelieving people." So Allah gave them the reward of this world and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
Good day to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio coming to you from Tehran. I'm Asma, your host for the next hour. We start with our news bulletin. That will be followed by The Ocean of Dua. The program explains supplications and prayers taken from various books such as Mafatih al-Jinan and Kamil al-Ziyarat. Our varied radio productions feature will round up this hour's programs. Stay with us for the next hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Spain cancels a weapons contract worth about 700 million euros with Israel over the regime's ongoing genocidal war on Gaza. Tehran underlines that all nations should be given guaranteed protection against any form of attack or threat of attack against their nuclear facilities. Hello and welcome, everyone. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. The Israeli genocide in Gaza claims more civilian lives as the regime launches almost non-stop airstrikes on Gaza City, along with artillery shelling and drone attacks. According to medical sources, over 60 Palestinians were killed on Monday, nearly 40 of them in northern Gaza, especially Gaza City. Israel also destroyed a number of residential towers, most notably the Al-Ghafri Tower, which was Gaza City's tallest building that sheltered hundreds of families. One of the regime's latest strikes hit residential homes in the Sabra and Al-Darraj neighborhoods of Gaza City, killing and injuring dozens of civilians. Three more Palestinians died of malnutrition, raising the toll of Israel's starvation policy to 425. Nearly 10 aid seekers were also killed by the regime's forces. The death toll from the Israeli genocide now exceeds 64,900, with more than 164,900 others injured. The Hamas resistance movement has strongly slammed the international community's failure to stop the Israeli regime's war crimes in the Gaza Strip. The movement's statement came as Israel presses ahead with its military aggression on the Gaza City, demolishing its high-rise buildings and forcefully displacing their residents. Hamas said the fascist Israeli army's brutal aggression against Gaza City constitutes a full-fledged crime of ethnic cleansing and genocide. It added that the regime continues to commit such crimes amid glaring international inaction and lack of decisive will on the part of the international community to stop them and hold their perpetrators accountable. Hamas stressed that Israel's crimes will fail to weaken the resolve of Palestinians who will continue their resistance and make the occupying regime pay dearly for its horrific crimes. Hamas warned that Israel's war criminal prime minister bears full responsibility for the fate of captives held in Gaza, and he will not succeed in releasing them through his criminal policies. Well, more than 80 international non-governmental organizations have called on countries and companies worldwide to end all forms of business dealings with Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestine. The call by the NGOs, including Oxfam and the Human Rights Association, was especially addressed to the European Union, which is Israel's largest trading partner. It came in a report which stressed the cooperation of foreign companies with Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank exacerbates the humanitarian crisis resulting from the Israeli occupation. It also called for a ban on financial institutions providing loans to companies involved in projects within those settlements. The report urged world countries, particularly EU members and the United Kingdom, to impose an explicit ban on any commercial or investment activity related to the settlements, including the provision of services and financing. Human rights activist Mohsen Naqvi joined us earlier. He argued that since the masses are waking up to the genocide committed by Israel, NGOs and the EU have to take some action to maintain their legitimacy.
This genocide has now spread across the world. People around the world are waking up. The masses are waking up. So companies like Oxfam and some of these other companies, they are, and the other NGOs, they are waking up for the sake of their own legitimacy. An NGO that does not call for some kind of a strike against the Zionist regime, or if they aren't taking some kind of action against genocide, they lose credibility from their donor bases, because this has become such a mainstream relevant issue amongst masses. If you look at international law, that these settlements are illegal under the Fourth Geneva Convention, and countless other UN resolutions, allowing trade with them rewards and sustains violations of human rights and international law. So the European Union, being an international body of sorts that governs countries within Europe, there's a free movement of goods within the European Union, and because the Zionist regime in Israel is a part of the European Union, it does bring about quite a bit of responsibility for the European Union to be able to abide by international law, to abide by the Geneva Convention, in holding its member state responsible, in this case, the Zionist regime.
Well, Israeli forces press ahead with their daily violent raids across the occupied West Bank, abducting more Palestinians and damaging their property. In one of their latest attacks, the regime's forces raided a town of Barta, southwest of Jenin, detaining a group of workers after storming homes and shops. According to local sources, Israeli forces took the abducted workers to an unknown location. Separately, the regime's forces began wide-scale land-leveling operations near the city of Tulkarm by bulldozing large tracts of Palestinian farmlands. The targeted lands include agriculture areas owned by Palestinians. Local sources say the operation is part of the regime's plan to seize more swaths of Palestinian land in order to expand its control over the occupied West Bank. While Luxembourg will join a number of European nations in recognizing the state of Palestine at the upcoming UN General Assembly, as outrage has grown over the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Prime Minister Luc Fridin and Foreign Minister Xavier Bettel communicated the decision to a parliamentary session. They asserted that the move is being coordinated with several other European Union member states, including France and Belgium. Last week, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen confirmed that the EU executive would suspend payments to the Israeli regime and impose sanctions on extremist ministers and violent Israeli settlers. The decision is part of the EU's broader reassessment of its relations with the Israeli regime in light of the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Nearly a dozen members of the European Union have already recognized the state of Palestine. Well, Spain has canceled a weapons contract worth hundreds of millions of euros with Israel over the regime's ongoing genocidal war on Gaza. The deal, worth nearly 700 million euros, would have seen Spain buying Israeli designated rocket launchers from the Elbit systems. The move followed Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez's pledge to turn into law a ban on all military sale or purchase deals with Israel over the regime's atrocities in Gaza. Madrid has also scrapped another contract valued at 287 million euros to buy anti-tank missile launchers, which were to be manufactured under license from an Israeli company. On Monday, Sanchez also called for Israel to be barred from international sports over the Gaza war. He expressed deep admiration for thousands of protesters who forced the halt of the final stage of the Vuelta a España, one of the world's biggest cycling races, in Spain on Sunday. Well, joining us from Deir al-Balah is our correspondent Ghad Ibrahim with the latest updates there from Gaza. Ghad, I mean, what can we say? Even Israeli ministers themselves are saying that Gaza is on fire after what we have seen all through the night. And Ghad, as yourself, you used to report for us from Gaza City. Now you have recently relocated to Deir al-Balah, as Gaza City is now having reports of land and ground invasions. What details do you have for us on the ground of the continued genocide?
Yes, exactly. Even the Israeli ministers are bragging about setting fire in Gaza City and leveling to the ground most of the buildings or the high-rise buildings of Gaza City and committing massacres against its people to force them out of the city. This night was really tough and very bloody for the people of Gaza, not only of Gaza, but in all of the Gaza Strip as well. The situation is really very catastrophic for the people in Gaza City. The Israeli occupation army committed massacres against the people in the north and also in the middle area. and starting from the north, a massacre, the most horrific massacre was when the Israeli occupation forces committed a massacre by an airstrike that targeted two residential blocks near Al-Amn Al-Am area in the north of Gaza, and that resulted of more than 60 people went missing under the rubble of these targeted buildings. The family of Mas'ud family and another for Zaqout family. Eight of the martyrs were actually recovered from the rubble of this targeted home. However, many, about 60 people are still buried under the rubble of these destroyed or these targeted homes. As you know, the civil crews or the civil defense crews are able to deal with this burden or are unable to deal with the very minimum capabilities they have in Gaza. They are exhausted. They don't have devices. They don't have machinery to deal with this amount of destruction or with this amount of rubble in order to extract those who are stuck under the rubble of these destroyed homes. This situation is really very dangerous as the bounding and the airstrikes are non-stop. The Israeli occupation army is targeting these areas with relentless airstrikes and with relentless artillery shelling and quadcopters shooting towards the people who are trying to rescue the injured or to rescue those who are stuck under the rubble of these destroyed homes. So many massacres against many families were committed since the midnight until now. Mas'ud family, Al-Khudri family, Zaqout family, and also in As-Sabra near Sahat Al-Shawa area, another family was targeted. So we are talking about very massive massacres against the people in Gaza City. The Israel occupation army is trying to terrorize the population of Gaza City in order to force them out of their city. However, many are still cramming in the west of Gaza. Many people are still jamming up in the tents in the west of Gaza. About 1 million Palestinians are still in the west of Gaza, jamming up in tents and cramming along the coastal line of the city. So the Israel occupation army has no option other than terrorizing them by massacres and by direct shooting and direct airstrikes towards them in order to terrorize them and to force them out of the city. We are talking about at least 38 people killed from midnight until now. And the last massacre was also or took place in Deir al-Balah city in the west of Deir al-Balah when an Israeli airstrike targeted a home to Timra's family, and that resulted in the killing of the mother, the father, and also a child. The same family has already lost two children in the beginning of the war. However, the rest of the family was killed this night as well. So we are talking about massacres not only in the north of Gaza, but also in the middle area and also in the south. In the past 24 hours, more than seven people were killed also of the aid seekers near the Nizarim corridor, those who arrived to Al-Awda hospital in the middle area. Four others were also killed in Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, which is actually designated by the Israeli army as a safe zone. The Israeli occupation army is claiming these areas in the middle area, Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, and Al-Mawasi area as actually humanitarian zones or safe zones. However, many massacres are committed every day in these areas. Many people are killed every day in these areas. So the last massacre took place here in Deir al-Balah against Timra's family. Another massacre was also committed against a family in the west of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. Against another family in the west of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, and that resulted in the killing of four of them after targeting the tent.
Well, exactly, Aghada. Again, a more heartbreaking stories of entire families being martyred, as you did mention. As always, please stay safe. Our correspondent there from Deir al-Balah, Aghada Ibrahim, and we will definitely get back to you as soon as we can. Professor Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, joined us earlier to discuss Spain's military embargo decision. He stated that while there is an inconsistency between Spain's rhetoric and practice, the move is nevertheless a welcome one.
Look, there's been a lot of inconsistencies in the Spanish government's approach here. They've been talking about the bans a lot while still carrying out business, but I think it's a welcome move. And there were already provisions in law for them to do it, which were breached because Spain is a net importer of Israeli weapons systems, basically. And as you say, it amounts to about $1 billion in the last 2 years since the October 2023 outbreak in Gaza. Uh, So, but I think it's going to send a very good signal to other European countries, other Western countries, that this should be done and can be done, despite the inconsistencies of Spain's actual practice. He's moving in the right direction, you know. He's been criticised for these inconsistencies and the difference between rhetoric and action, but nevertheless, I think it's a laudable thing. And as I said, it's going to also have a flow-on effect to the rest of the European countries and other Western countries. So I don't think too much should be made about the criticisms. He has been consistent at a rhetorical level in his rejection of the Israeli genocide. They recognised Palestine as a nation last year, more than a year ago. So there's a slow progress but at least he's acting, because really what the world requires now is action from these governments that have been sponsoring or engaged in trade with the Israelis to tighten this boycott. And I think it's we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that it's a very welcome move, and it's catching up in practice what he's been saying in rhetoric for quite some time now.
Well, Iran has reaffirmed that all nations possess the inalienable right to develop nuclear energy for peaceful purposes and should be afforded guaranteed protection against any form of attack or threat against their nuclear facilities. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei underscored that nations must refrain from launching attacks or issuing threats against the peaceful nuclear facilities of other states. He further called upon the international community to take decisive action to prevent the increasing normalization of lawlessness in international relations. Baghaei made the comments in a social media post regarding a draft resolution tabled by Iran and five partners, including China and Russia, at the ongoing General Conference of the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. The proposed resolution calls for a ban on any act of aggression or threats against nuclear sites and facilities under the IAEA safeguards. The Iranian spokesman emphasized that this initiative is aimed at safeguarding the integrity of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT. Well, thank you very much, everyone. Goodbye for now.
Ocean of Dua. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the Ocean of Dua. And in this version of the program, we are trying to cover some of the names of the Almighty Allah that are recommended to be recited to invoke Him for obtaining benefits. So stay with us. Dear brothers and sisters, Al-Mutakabbir, the Sublime, is another name of the Almighty Allah. This name can also be recited in the beginning of our dua to gain more benefits from the Almighty Allah. Another name of the Almighty Allah, dear listeners, is Al-Musawwir, the Fashioner. Another name of the Almighty Allah, which is closely related to the Humiliator, or Al-Khafid, which was mentioned in details in the previous program, is the name Al-Mudhil, the Disgracer. The Almighty Allah is the absolute cause, and He is both Al-Mudhil and Al-Mu'izz. Al-Mu'izz literally means the bestower of honor. So reciting Al-Mu'izz in a great deal will bring honor and recognition and fame. Of course, all the things we are mentioning in this program, dear listeners, have some different conditions to be met if we want to achieve the results. But whatever happens, reciting these names of the Almighty Allah will bring more the attraction of the Almighty Allah, and we can gain more benefits, especially while we are invoking Him and reciting dua. Another name is Al-Muqit, the Maintainer. This name is specially beneficial to have enough sustenance. So we have been all advised to recite as many times as possible the name Al-Muqit, the Maintainer, since by reciting this name, we will remind ourselves that the only one that we should refer to is the Almighty Allah, the Absolute Cause, the Maintainer, Al-Muqit.
Walhamdulillahi ala afwihi ba'da qudrati. Walhamdulillahi ala tuli anatihi fi ghadabi. وهو قادر على ما يريد الحمد لله خالق الخلق باسط الرزق فالق الإصباح ذي الجلال والإكرام والفضل والإنعام الذي بعد فلا يرى وقرب فشهد النجوى.
The name Al-Mujib means the hearer of the prayers. The Almighty Allah is the hearer of the prayers, and He will respond to them, whether we see it or not. The Almighty Allah has promised to answer to all those true and honest prayers, but the fact that we don't see them apparently doesn't necessarily mean that the Almighty Allah is not listening to them or is not responding to them. So that's why before making a request to the Almighty Allah, we should always recite Al-Mujib. By reciting this name, we will gain more benefits, inshallah. But this, that by reciting this name, the Almighty Allah will, a'udhu billah, be tempted to answer our prayers, is totally wrong. Reciting these names, all the names that we mention in these programs, is just for reminding ourselves that the one who we are referring to and invoking to has these names and characteristics. So we will be steadfast and stay firm on our request to the Almighty Allah, and we'll be sure that He will respond to them.
I remember when I first met you.
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim, He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad, He is the source of generosity, then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, "Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad." Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Har khujo keshti ab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Ab kamju tishnagi avar bedast. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. Ta beju shad ab az bala va pas. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the merciful God will come towards you.
Paradise, thank you Allah. Now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever.
The ocean of dua.
Another name of the Almighty Allah is Al-Majid, which is also one of the known names of the Holy Quran as well. So Majid means the glorious. Also, another name of the Almighty Allah that can be recited while we are trying to invoke him is Al-Mubdi, which literally translates to commencer, the commencer. Since the Almighty Allah is the absolute cause, so he is the commencer of everything. Another name is Al-Mu'id, which means the restorer. Since the Almighty Allah is the one who can restore everyone after they were dead, and he is also the only one to start and originate a life, this name perfectly suits him. Dear listeners, two well-known names of the Almighty Allah are Al-Muhyi and also Al-Mumit. Al-Muhyi means the vivifier, the one who enlivens everything. Also, the name Al-Mumit, which literally can be translated into annihilator. Of course, all the things we are mentioning in this program, dear listeners, have some different conditions to be met if we want to achieve the results. But whatever happens, reciting these names of the Almighty Allah will bring more the attraction of the Almighty Allah, and we can gain more benefits, especially while we are invoking him and reciting dua. And the last name of the Almighty Allah that will be discussed in this program is the name Al-Muqtadir. Al-Muqtadir means the all-powerful. Since the Almighty Allah is the creator and the absolute cause of this whole universe, he is also the all-powerful. If the servant and the reciter believes in the meaning of this name and believes that the Almighty Allah is the only one to be referred to in the hardships and difficulties. But all these being said, the one condition to all these names to be recited in the beginning or in the middle of our du'as is our belief and faith in them, to know that the Almighty Allah is the only one that these names perfectly suit, and that a true servant will never get anywhere else except he or she turns to the real Lord. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program as well. We ask the Almighty Allah to brighten our hearts with the light of faith. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Voices in global politics that challenge mainstream narratives and stir debate across ideological lines. They blend scientific training with fierce political conviction, using digital platforms to amplify perspectives often sidelined in Western discourse. My guest today is one such figure, a commentator whose outspoken views on Syria, foreign intervention, and media bias have earned both admiration and criticism. Her journey from science student to geopolitical influencer reflects the power of online activism in shaping public opinion. Welcome to SORP. I am Bahman Ray. Maram Soosli, also known by her online aliases Syrian Girl and Mimi Alam, is a Syrian-Australian political commentator and media personality. With a background in biophysics and chemistry from the University of Western Australia, she rose to prominence through her YouTube channel and social media platforms, where she shares commentary on the Syrian civil war, US foreign policy, and global geopolitics. Her work has appeared on outlets such as RT, Press TV, and Al Mayadeen. Maram Soosli, very good to have you on SORP.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
The pleasure is all mine. Tell me something. What was your experience, Maram, growing up in Damascus before moving to Australia?
Well, I left Damascus when I was very young, and I really remember, what I remember the most is my family was there, and my cousins who I would play with, my aunts, my uncles, my grandparents. And when I left Syria and Damascus, I found myself constantly trying to my hardest to hold on to any memory I had of my family. And so maybe I remember that time with rose-colored glasses, but I used to always think that those were the best years of my life, you know, the first few years, actually.
Can you tell me?
I moved to Australia when I was 7.
And what years were those 7 years?
What years were they?
Yeah.
They were in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s.
And what do you remember from Syria back then as a 7-year-old?
You know, it was very peaceful. It was, you know, we could go to the playground, like the Jahez, the people were happy, you know, and it's not like I haven't been back to Syria since then. I had been back several times. And there's something charming about it that I think is lost now. You know, that old, people might think of it as something that I shouldn't say, but the old Soviet kind of bloc countries, they were quaint. They had their own, like, simple charm about them, not complicated with materialism. And I just, yeah, I remember the community the most.
Tell me about what led you to pursue studies in biophysics and chemistry at the University of Western Australia, right?
Yeah, thank you. Well, you know what? I was just very good at chemistry, and I just thought it would be easier, because if I were to have studied political science, then the professor might have a disagreement with me politically, is what I expected. And I thought to myself, you know, they won't be able to fight me if I do science, because who can argue with science?
Right.
They can't argue with me on a political basis. I do love chemistry, and I'm here for the Mustafa Prize, which is in science.
Of course, it's a pleasure to have you.
Yes, thank you. And so, unfortunately, I was wrong about that. Turns out they can definitely still fight you politically, even if you choose science.
Science is your field.
Yes, they can make sure that your career in science is hurt, in spite of it being, you know, it shouldn't involve politics. But that was the basis of my decision, because also the other thing is, I feel like you can not learn science on your own. You really need a teacher. But politics, you can live it and you can breathe it, and it can just be a part of you without having to study it formally. And I like the concept of a Renaissance soul, someone who isn't just one thing, they're everything.
Absolutely. And in a way, I think you made the right choice, because you, by going through science, you kind of build up a sort of background, and you come from the world within to know the world outside. So that's beautiful, you know, kind of the turn from science and from the world within into the outer world. That's very interesting, though, actually. And I'm sure it kind of shaped your perspective into politics and everything.
I think it brought a bit of the scientific method to analysis of politics as well. And sort of when you make a prediction about what's going to happen in the future, you can almost use science in a way. You can use axioms, you know, methods, formulas. Not so rigid, but in a way you can kind of say, like, an axiom of in real politic, which I no longer ascribe to, but in real politic, a nation will always do what is in its interest. Of course, I don't believe that to be true anymore. But that is
why is that? That is also very interesting. Why don't you believe in that?
Because I feel that sometimes a nation will not act in the interest of itself or its people, but in the interest of the economic of the individual, or the, you know, sometimes people make mistakes as well.
Yeah.
So if a nation does something that is against its own interest, like the US, for example, when it basically commits suicide on the altar of Zionism, that doesn't really benefit the American people. So it's kind of it breaks that real politic axiom down. You have to invent new axioms to explain the world.
I see. All right. Were there moments during your university years that sparked your interest in geopolitics?
To be honest, it started in high school. I think I attended my first pro-Palestine rally at the age of 15. I think that the 9/11 was very radicalizing, because after that there was the war in Afghanistan, followed by the war in Iraq. And I was protesting the war in Afghanistan even as a teenager. And then I was looking for any activists that were protesting the Iraq war as well. So I think that I, by virtue of where I come from and understanding just some things about politics there, I already had a sense of justice that I wanted to follow. It wasn't until, you know, it was from teenagehood to university before I started my YouTube channel.
Right, and tell me something. You were 15, you just said.
Yes.
You know, what was your worldview back then, and how did you come up to the growth of realizing that you had to join in these solidarity movements?
You know, I'm thinking back now. I think I started watching the news when I was about 12, and I felt like I was being lied to. And I feel silly to say this now. At 12, I wrote a letter to the news asking them why they expected us to be so stupid. This was to the Australian news.
Do you remember the specific news story that you wrote about?
I don't. I just remember thinking that you're insulting our intelligence, and yeah, I wrote an email, I think, to them, and it was a tabloid show, yeah. So of course they're going to insult your intelligence. I think it was, Australians would know it as, you know, Channel 9, not the news, but after the news, it's like Current Affairs. It was Current Affairs. So I guess from there grew a skepticism about the media and what we're being told, and investigating it myself. And I was, I guess, exposed as well, because, you know, when you're Syrian, you're not alone in Australia. You also have your own community, and you have a Lebanese
diaspora,
Lebanese especially diaspora, and you get exposed to other news, international news, and then you compare and you understand that there's lies. And I think that feeling of there's people are lying, it just made me angry, and it drove me to act and go to protest.
So that feeling hit you at the very age of 15.
Yeah, 12 to 15.
Tell me something, how long did it take for you to decide to do something about it, to get out of the loop of mainstream media?
It was the war. It was the war in Afghanistan. That's what caused me to...
The so-called war on terror.
Yes, and then when the war in, I just thought it was unjust, and that all these children were being murdered, and America doing it in a way that I thought they had planned. I read that they had plans for the war before 9/11, and so I thought, okay, there's something else going on here. It's not just terrorism that they're filing. There's something else. And then when the war in Iraq started, I had this strong sense that Syria was going to be next.
How so?
Well, of course, there was General Wesley Clark that said there was 7 countries in 5 years. But he said that in 2005, 2006. I had that sense in 2003. I guess I could explain it by saying, you know, there was the axis of evil. Although Syria, I don't think it was one of them? It was Iran, North Korea, and Iraq.
Yeah.
So it wasn't Syria, but I thought, well, like, obviously, Syria is going to be next. And it made me upset or angry that not more is being done to stop this war in Iraq.
And what were the first steps that you took in order to raise awareness?
Well, look, I was just a teenage girl, so there wasn't much that I could do.
But you had social media.
I had social media, but at the time I was completely anonymous online. I only became in the public eye when the war in Syria began. So during...
Back in 2011, right?
Yeah, exactly. So before that, I was very paranoid and anonymous on the internet, but in real life, I would go to protests, I would give leads at university for students, and I would join activist groups. But all of that, when the internet came about and became another voice for the people and, you know, an alternative to the mainstream media, which had dominated for so long, I realized that there was more power staying inside on the internet than even being outside on the street. That's not always the case, but for some people, and it's for some, like, if you do it in the right way, it can be just as powerful, if not more powerful, than being on the street.
Naomi just said that in the very beginning, You were mostly anonymous. I'm curious to know why.
Well, I a few reasons. Firstly, naturally, privacy and anonymity is a strength in life, and you know, you're protecting your identity, your family, from targeting, from being politically targeted.
Yeah.
But at the time, especially at the start of 2003, the Iraq War, there was I was concerned about what Australia called sedition laws, and there was sort of a chilling effect. They announced that if you support the Iraqi resistance or any kind of resistance against the U.S. Invasion, then you could be charged with sedition. And sedition means to go against your government. Yeah. Oh. So I was worried about that. I think in retrospect, it was a bluff. Like, you know, but I didn't have the wisdom at the time as a teenager to understand that.
Well, if you ask me, you had a lot of wisdom. But anyways, tell me something. How did you transition from science into political commentary?
I think I just always had both at the same time. They kind of conflict. Sometimes they work together, especially when the topic of the news is science. For example, the chemical attacks in Syria, which, you know, now if you were to listen to the Turkish news, which was last week, they'll say that the first chemical attack that happened was in Ghouta in 2013, and they will say that, you know, this is like the anniversary of that. But they will completely forget that 6 months before that, there was an attack on a government-held area in Aleppo, for example. And my knowledge of chemistry did help in understanding what was happening, how they were lying, why they were lying, etc. But the two sides of me do compete, and unfortunately, the science side has suffered because of the political side. How did I transition? I did an interview one time with a guy called 108 Morris 108. Nice. YouTube has shut him down now, and unfortunately, he's passed away. But it went viral, and I realized because it went viral, it was called Al-Qaeda is Al-Qaeda. And because it went viral, I decided I could do more.
So that was like the kind of a main motivation for you to publicly start and share your views?
It was the war in Syria. I thought, you know what, if this is my identity and my privacy is worth sacrificing to expose the truth about what's happening in Syria. Because
right.
That's my duty to my birth country.
Of course. I want you to expand a little bit about the vision that you had for launching the YouTube channel and adopting the name Syrian Girl.
Well, Syrian Girl was not the name I originally adopted. It was actually given to me by 108 Morris 108, this gentleman he made excellent videos. Unfortunately, YouTube deleted all his interviews and then he passed away. But he gave me an anonymous name because at the beginning I was still trying to maintain some level of anonymity by not revealing my full name. My original name that I wanted to give myself was Partisan Girl. And which means resistance girl. And, you know, that sort of, but I was talking about Syria, so it's easy, Syrian girl. So he actually advised me to start a channel. I wanted to talk about a topic, and he said, I'm not interested in this topic, you should create your own YouTube channel and talk about it.
Right, and how did your content evolve as the Syrian civil war intensified?
Well, you know, at the beginning it was about breaking.
Did you ever visit Syria during the civil war?
In fact, I visited the year that the last visit was in 2011.
Oh,
yeah.
I see that. So it was the country was already involved with the war, or it was beforehand?
It was just the cusp of it. So I saw Syria at its most beautiful. And then not since then.
Could you see the turmoil coming?
You know, Libya, obviously. I could see the writing on the wall from Libya. Yes.
I see.
But when I was there before that, because I would visit every year or every 2 years, I would visit, there was no indication, except for Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera was a big indicator. Too many people were watching it. Too many satellite dishes were open to it. And I could see it had a very negative influence.
Oh.
Yes.
So you think
on society.
It kind of had the effect of mainstream media on this specific topic?
I think that it, especially Al Jazeera in Arabic, had more of a sectarian vibe to it. So that's why I, you know, and Al Arabiya as well. So those two channels on Syrian satellite television, I think that that wasn't a good sign. Also, the president at the time, Bashar al-Assad, he did open up the country because they were demanding this of him in 2009. And he did so by, like, allowing Facebooks and the internet and stuff. I also saw already that Facebook was a maligned influence. So I wasn't really particularly happy with the way that the country was going with the rapprochement to the West, because I guess I live in the West. And so for Syrians, what they would see as something desirable that they want to be a part of, I actually saw it for its flaws.
Yeah.
And I saw in Syrian society the things that they themselves didn't value or didn't think was cool or interesting. Like, for example, the principle of self-sufficiency, where, you know, we don't have iPhones, but we would produce our own electronics, or, maybe we don't have the latest fashions, but we create our own fashions.
Right.
And they were more interested in KFCs and new KFCs opening, whereas I liked the fact that Syria had a unique set of cuisine and restaurants that you can't get anywhere else in the world.
Of course.
So this is something, unfortunately, that I don't think will survive the new regime.
Of course. And what challenges have you faced in maintaining an independent voice online?
Well, I've had many death threats.
Death threats?
Yes, absolutely. From various sources. The Jolanists, for example, the ones that are supporting the current Al-Qaeda leader. And the ISIS, of course, the Israelis. Many death threats from the Israelis. Attacks from the Zionist lobby. Being named by the ADL, being named by Australian Zionist lobbies, attacked at my workplace or university. Like, they would, for years, send harassing letters. Actually, one of the funniest things that happened in 2014 was there's a guy called Dan Cazzetta, who worked for a guy called Elliot Higgins. And they were responsible for trying to manufacture consent for a war on Syria. And this Dan Cazzetta guy is entitled to Israeli citizenship, just FYI. And he wrote a letter to my university claiming that I was working with sarin gas in the laboratory. But I was doing theoretical chemistry. My work was all on the computer. So, yeah, this I have the letter. And, you know, the repercussions from that wasn't so bad, because obviously
right.
it was a joke what he did. But the guy he was working with, Elliot Higgins, the British Foreign Office also attacked me. They called me a Russian bot. You know, there was many media attacks that exposed my identity was doxed, my address was doxed. The media would write harassing pieces about me constantly. And there's too many people to fight all the time. This is a problem. They tried to prevent me from submitting my PhD. So all of those things happen. But these are very small things compared to the suffering of people who are under the bombs or the soldiers that have to go to the front lines. So for me, it's a very simple sacrifice to make. So I always wondered if what I was doing had any positive effects. But I feel that recently more and more people have come to me and told me that I've changed their minds, or I started them on a journey when they were young, and they became who they were. Even people inside Australian Parliament have told me that, you know, watching my Twitter feed has changed their mind. Like, they were supportive of Israel for 20 years, but because of the seeing what's happening in Gaza on my feed, suddenly they've looked at everything completely differently. Lucas Gage, he wrote the song Boom Boom Tel Aviv. He will tell you that there was a time where his Twitter account was deleted, and you know, I brought it back. I helped him bring it back. So I feel like in small ways I planted some seeds and I'm watching them grow. And I hope in future, my future is that the front lines are not going very well, to be perfectly frank, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Gaza. And hopefully they will be better in Iran. But there is another front line, and it's in the West. And it's the hearts and minds of the West. And that's where my future focus is going to be.
I wanted the conversation to go on for hours, but unfortunately, for the sake of time, we have to bring this to a close. But as a tradition of our show, towards the end of the program, our guests usually have 1 or 2 minutes to talk directly to our audience. Will become yours, so feel free to share whatever you want with our audience.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me. I didn't know that I was going to be talking mostly about myself, so I apologize for that. I guess the most important thing I can tell you is that Israel is the Jewish ISIS, and they will not stop unless they are stopped. I feel that for the benefit of Iran, whilst, you know, I respect the opinions of the administration, I feel that the way of North Korea is the way to go, and there's nothing wrong with Iran having the nuclear bomb. In fact, I think the atomic bomb maybe the only way to protect Iran's borders, because Israel does have the atomic bomb, and they need an answer to that. Otherwise, they're going to continue to attack furiously. So I wish Iran the best of luck. I hope that it remains the backbone of the resistance. I'm sorry that Syria can't participate, but hopefully in future everything will change and our alliance will return.
Maram Sisley, it was a pleasure to have you on SOAP.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Thank you for staying with us on another SOAP. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Bahman Rai.
Say that love strikes only once, that precious moment I offer you. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining moon? Where is the
I possess, I offer you. I want to be someone whom you can trust. Come save us from a world that's so unjust. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of hope? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest road? Where is
You are listening to Iran Radio and Straight.